Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainslie, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by a special guest at UNNC, Dr. Kevin Tai. Kevin is Assistant Professor of Language and Literacy Education and Co-Director of the Center for Advancement in Inclusive and Special Education at the Faculty of Education in the University of Hong Kong.
That's right. Kevin is the editor of the Language Learning Journal, assistant editor of the International Journal of Bilingual Education and Bilingualism, and executive guest editor of Learning and Instruction. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and the Higher Education Academy. And in 2024, he was listed in the world's top 2% most cited scientists in the field of languages and linguistics.
Wow.
That's very impressive. I'm nowhere near there.
You'll get there one day, Derek.
I aspire to it. Thank you.
Keep going, keep going. Earlier this year, Kevin published the article, Transpositioning in English Medium Instruction Classroom Discourse, Insights from a Translanguaging Perspective.
That's super slow there, Mary.
Well, there was a lot of trans there.
There's a lot of transpositioning,
translanguaging. And I also had to actually learn what those terms mean.
Okay.
All right. Okay. And let me finish.
Please do.
He published that in the Journal of Language and Education.
Which is an amazing journal.
So is it?
Very, very well done, Kevin.
Yeah, because we're in your ballpark here.
Oh. Yeah, actually, again, I'm lucky this week because I feel a little more comfortable. I'm a linguist, so I'm quite familiar with these terms. Mm-hmm. But I do have lots of questions for Kevin as well.
So
it's not as easy for him.
So this means that I can just sit back and just like...
Not at all, no.
Because
he's going to have to explain these kind of core concepts to you. Translanguaging, I think, is the more common term.
Common to you.
Right.
It's the first time I've come across this term, actually.
Okay.
This is totally new for me. And Kevin did actually explain it really well in his paper, but I'm still going to get him to explain it again, actually. And also kind of I really enjoyed reading this because it made me actually reflect a lot on my own teaching, I think. And it made me realize that there are certain things that I do that work quite well and that I actually don't realize that I'm doing them in essence. Because I was sort of reading through this and there's a really good sort of qualitative analysis of a guy teaching here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of noting like, oh, that's a really good idea. Or, oh, I've done that bit before in this way. So I think I got a lot out of this paper, I have to say.
And it's very similar context, right? So we're here at Ningbo, which is predominantly Chinese students who are here, although not Cantonese. So most of our students speak a form of Mandarin as a first language.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that straightforward because quite a few of our students also are international.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a very fluid situation where you may be switching amongst a lot of different semiotic resources. So modalities, right?
Mm-hmm.
We use PowerPoints and other aids along with language.
Although I was happy to see that the example of teaching that Kevin used had a good old chalkboard.
That was
involved.
Impressive.
Yeah.
We need more of that.
I know, old school.
And then you can punish students by making them beat the chalk brushes at the end of class if they've been misbehaving.
That's how it used to be.
We've all been there, old school classrooms.
All right. Actually, I think it's about time that we actually invited Kevin to actually tell us a little bit about his paper and to give us an overview of the paper. So can you please give us an introduction to this and for our listeners, maybe about the topic and the main argument of your paper? Thank you.
And welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary and Derek, for inviting me to participate in this podcast interview. This paper, I would argue that it is the first study that provides empirical evidence in terms of what transpositioning means and what it looks like in classroom interaction. So first of all, maybe let me quickly explain what translanguaging means. So translanguaging is an emerging term in the field of applied linguistics, which aims to capture how multilinguals like ourselves mobilize diverse multilingual and also multi-semiotic resources in the process of creating new knowledge. So if you think about everyday life communication, we are actually mobilizing different resources to create new meanings in classroom settings, in business settings, or even in film and media. The idea of transpositioning was coined in around December 2023 by Li Wei and also Tongqing Li. They were arguing that in the process of engaging in translanguaging, we also switch our positions. We engage in different social roles in conversations. So that idea was inspired by the concepts of positioning theory and also liquid modernity. These two concepts, they emphasize the idea that, you know, identities are fluid and social roles. We constantly switch our social roles depending on the context and our communicative goals.
So in the context in your paper, this transpositioning, if I understand it right, was the idea that the teacher themselves will kind of put themselves in different positions in order to facilitate learning.
Exactly. So I think it's because in traditional classroom settings, particularly in China, for example, the teacher was standing in the front of the classroom, and that's pretty much it. The teacher won't really walk around the classroom to look at what students are doing or try to think about the student from the student's perspective. So transpositioning is really encouraging us as teachers to think about how we can adopt different social roles in order to engage in the process of teaching and learning. In the paper, I provided two examples. So the first example is co-learning. The process of co-learning is actually a concept that comes from education. And it really means that we as teachers, we are not only the providers of knowledge to our students, our students can also provide new knowledge to the teacher. And so such a role, such a process, you know, the students are also adopting the role as an expert. And that is very important, particularly if you're teaching classes that adopt English as the medium of instruction. For English language classes, that will be easier because the curriculum itself is about everyday life topics. But if you're teaching maths or science or history, the kind of content knowledge, it's always perceived as more important than other kinds of knowledge that students bring in. So co-learning is emphasizing that we are denying a privilege in one knowledge over the other.
Is that better for learning?
Not necessarily facilitating content learning, but definitely playing a very important role in the process of building students' motivation to learn the content subject with you as a teacher. If that student is that's really keen to learn the subject with you as a person, very likely the student won't have the motivation to learn the subject with you. I think that's more relevant in primary or secondary education where they're forced to take classes, you know, that's not something that they would like to do, like maths, for example. I hate to do maths when I was in high school.
Not the only one, yeah.
So would you say, Kevin, that this fits along the lines of a kind of shift from teacher-centered classroom through a kind of student-centered classroom and then into a learning-centered classroom? So actually integrating more contemporary theories of education.
Exactly. So it really aligns with, you know, the pedagogical approaches like communicative language teaching. It's all about getting our students to speak up in class and creating that authentic classroom environment. It's always important to bear in mind that even though we have all these pedagogical approaches, but they do not necessarily emphasize the need that it's not only teachers who need to engage in transpositioning. I mean, students, when they're doing different kinds of authentic activities, they should be kind of trained to engage in transpositioning, because that's the kind of intercultural communication skills that we will need to develop as we grow older, as we engage in professional communication.
I'm sort of thinking back to my experience when I've been learning something and the way in which I've sort of positioned myself via the teacher. And it sort of feels like when I've had sort of the best learning experience is often when you feel like you're actually contributing to educating somebody else at the same time. So I can totally see how that works. And I'm thinking that if we have any students who are listening to this, which I know that quite a few of our students do, I'm wondering if they're actually thinking in their minds about when actually they had this experience too.
And that teachers are people too.
So no, they're not.
Oh, it's true.
No, they're not.
You know, this reminds me of a kind of empathy question, right? So that as teachers, we wish to place ourselves into the position of the students. Mm. But hopefully in doing so, it creates a more dynamic and reciprocal relationship. So
indeed.
That they can also think in terms of, well, being a teacher. So if we can be them, they can also be us.
Mm, definitely. I think the whole idea of transpositioning is also helping not only the teacher, but also students to develop that kind of empathetic attitude. Because when you're engaging in transpositioning, you're trying to adopt other people's perspective. So it really, so emphasizing the idea that identity is always, it's ongoing and it's very dynamic, constantly switching. As you switch your identity, you're trying to think from other people's perspective. Mm. And it's something that, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's also, of course, there's another layer here as well, because you're not just talking about this transpositioning, you're also combining it with translanguaging as well, which is the kind of element that seems to take it much further in your paper. Because I was very impressed in your paper by your analysis. It was this lovely kind of qualitative analysis. You videoed a guy teaching, and it was a maths class, of course. But this wasn't only about transpositioning. It was about what you call translanguaging.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about this?
So I think the notion of translanguaging was first developed maybe around 2010. And then the idea of transpositioning was an extension from the concept of translanguaging. So Professor Li Wei, who was my former PhD supervisor at University College London, he is like a leading scholar.
Oh, you're from UCL.
Yes, I'm from UCL, Institute of Education. And I did my PhD there for 3 years. And for my own doctoral research, I was looking at how the teacher employs translanguaging practices in Hong Kong English medium instruction classroom. And what I have noticed is that people always assume that translanguaging is similar to code switching, where you just switch between one named language to another, like switching from English to Mandarin. Mm-hmm. But our use of language is more complicated than this. You know, the ways that we are using different languages, like we switch between different accents, different ways of speaking, like switching between academic register to everyday life register, and also mobilizing diverse multimodal resources like body language. You know, traditionally, these are part of language, but it's just grammarians decide not to include them in dictionaries.
What? Why?
Well, let's not insult the grammarians here.
We've begun something.
there's a concept called first language languaging and second order language. So first order languaging really refers to what kind of resources that we mobilize in everyday life, in everyday life social interactions. Second order language means what the grammarians and linguists do to codify them in books, grammar books, dictionaries. studies.
But not all grammarians are prescriptive. So,
yes.
Some grammarians are more equal than others.
It's very true. And in fact, some linguists more broadly, but grammarians mm-hmm. as well, would look at notions of identity and how those are inscribed, for example, in cultural milieus or the use of accents or non-standard varieties, of course. Mm. So.
But because we still have the kind of linguistic bias in the field of applied linguistics, we're not really seeing multimodal resources as part of that idea of language. So translanguaging aims to really embrace the repertoire that we have and how we mobilize that in conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it depends in some ways where you're looking at linguistics as well. So because I do a kind of functional linguistics, that already has theories of tenor relationships and how those can evolve through the ongoing conversation, for example, where someone might switch their tenor relationship with someone else and this type of thing. And similarly, there's some very well-developed multimodal work that's being done both to study a kind of text, but also in classroom situations and things like that. This I think, is really wonderful work, though, in the sense that it shows the kind of integration of the multiple repertoires. Mm. And, you know, a lot of multimodality doesn't deal with different languages.
Yeah.
And doesn't deal with language crossing or what we're calling translanguaging here, or the integration of, you know, in a language classroom, it's a great question, you know, how much of the L1, so the first language, should you be employing in order to teach an L2? Mm. And this is really interesting, too, because it's dealing with EMI, so English as a Medium of Instruction, or CLIL, so that's Clearly. Content. What is it? Content?
Content and language
integrated learning.
Yeah, there was a lot of acronyms in this one.
Well, we love the acronyms in linguistics. But yeah, anyway, sorry to jump in. I had to defend the grammarians because not all grammars are prescriptive, and even descriptive grammars can often be.
You feeling better now?
Not fully, but we'll get there.
Okay. All right. Okay. Where were we?
I can ask more questions if you like.
Hold on a moment.
Okay, please.
Okay. This was one actual issue that I was hoping you could explain to our listeners, because I got this from reading the paper. But ultimately, what is the difference between translation and translanguaging? Because translanguaging, from the understanding here, it was sort of switching from one language to the other, but not necessarily actually translating in a sense. Is that correct?
So some scholars, so my colleague at the University of Hong Kong, Tong King Lee, he actually wrote a book about translation and translanguaging, exploring the connection between the two. I think it depends on how you do the translation. If you simply just switch from language, one language to another, then you can consider that as translation. But translanguaging is really more fluid. It's not like you must translate one sentence to another in a very consistent manner. You can include like emojis or like body language in order to showcase one particular concept while you're speaking something. So it's more like fluid use of different linguistic features and multimodal features in writing. So we have researchers that look at translanguaging in academic writing, formative assessment.
This is something that I'm really glad to actually have a name for, because I recognize that at certain points in my life when I've been working in a second language that I'm certain that I have done this, and I'm sure I've heard my students do it occasionally as well, or particularly when you have two people conversing in different languages together, you know, and they sort of pepper their kind of their speech with the words from each language, in essence, you know. Yes. So I'm really glad to have a name for that.
Yes.
Also, what I was super glad to see was that this concept came from bilingual Welsh classrooms in the 1990s.
Yes.
Is that correct? Because I remember this movement to elevate the Welsh language in the UK. So I love the fact that this actually was came from not far from my hometown in this way.
Yes. So translanguaging was actually from developed by Ken Williams in Welsh. I think it's Bangor University.
Oh.
And he first coined the notion to capture the situation where the teachers were using Welsh, but the blackboard materials, textbooks were in English. So the input was in Welsh, but, you know, I think what he was arguing is that when students are listening to the input, they don't just listen to what the teacher are saying. And that's what code switching is trying to argue. It's just, you know, you're switching from one language to another. But when you're listening to when you're trying to make sense of the input, the students are actually listening to the teacher's utterance and also the surroundings, the materials, the writings on the blackboard, the PowerPoints, the textbooks, in order to fully understand the whole message. Mm-hmm. So he was, but at that time, you know, that was back in 1994, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So he was still looking at that switch between different named languages, but now we kind of expand that further.
I assume we also sort of incorporate now kind of the digital world in this way too.
But for Ken Williams' work, that kind of context is actually quite similar to English as the medium of instruction context in different parts of the world, because they are using Welsh as the medium of instruction to teach content subjects. So the idea of translanguaging was developed in the field of education.
Mm.
Yeah. Linguists further develop that.
Yes.
Yes, as a theory of language.
It feels also like there are a lot of you doing this in Hong Kong.
Mm.
And Hong Kong is a sort of ideal situation to look at this because there are sort of so many languages over there and people seem to switch from one to the other and have quite a high level.
Mm.
So it feels like this is an ideal environment.
I would say so, yeah.
For you to look at this concept.
Yeah.
That actually brings up a question that I had, because I don't know the kind of language policy in Hong Kong. And you do mention near the end of the paper that you're hoping that this idea would have some form of influence on policy. And I'm just wondering what the current situation in terms of language use in the classroom is. So right at the end, you say policymakers in Hong Kong are encouraged to view translanguaging as a valuable tool for fostering linguistic diversity in EMI classrooms and for optimizing language users' comprehensive linguistic and semiotic resources in building knowledge and engaging in transpositioning. And then they highlight the necessity for Hong Kong to establish this plurilingual model. And I'm just wondering, how easy is it? Because this is a perennial problem. Linguists don't have much influence. And even in our own fields, right, when we're talking about language learning in the classroom and things like that, it's very difficult to budge the kind of test-based traditional approach to you know, multiple choice grammar answers and things like that. So what is the policy? What are you hoping to change about the policy? And do you think there's any hope of doing so?
I mean, it's very difficult because at the moment in Hong Kong, we have the biliteracy and trilingualism policy that was adopted by the Education Bureau. So we expect students to be biliterate in English and Chinese and trilingualism in terms of being able to speak English, Cantonese and Mandarin.
Wow.
But that's the goal, really. So, you know, Chinese and English, these are compulsory subjects. And if you go to secondary school, so most of our primary schools in Hong Kong, they adopt Chinese as the medium of instruction. Only a few elite schools will adopt English as the medium of instruction. And then when you go to the secondary school level, that's where all the controversy issues comes in, because we have around, at that time, we have around 114 schools that receive exemptions. They were able to adopt English as the medium of instruction. And the rest of the schools were classified as Band 2 and Band 3 schools. These are not so good schools, and they are forced to use Chinese as the medium of instruction. But the issue with adopting EMI, which is like a global phenomenon, these, we all share similar issues, is that the teachers, the content teachers, are not well trained in using English to teach their respective subjects. Okay. And the students, they do not have the academic language proficiency to learn the subject in English. Because as I said, the English curriculum and content subject, academic language, these are completely two different things. So we have seen real life examples, including this paper, because these are naturally occurring data, is that what we can see is the teachers are switching between Cantonese and English to facilitate the teaching. But then according to the Education Bureau, EMI policy means it has to be English only. You are not allowed to use other named languages to facilitate the process of teaching and learning. And I've heard some schools will actually yell at their teachers if the school principal walk past the classroom, they will ask the teacher to reteach that particular part where you use Chinese. So some schools really adopt the really strict English-only policy. I think no matter what I say, I don't know whether I can convince the Education Bureau because...
We'll try to help, Kevin, but I've seen it in other areas.
Really?
It just doesn't change things much.
Fine. It's just difficult. I think it depends on whether you are able to be involved in the Education Bureau, maybe as one of the committee members for the Standing Committee for Language Education, or whether you are being invited to serve as one of the school managers, because in schools, they have school management committees. So if you're invited to be the committee member at that school, maybe you can play a role in influencing the teachers about the benefits of translanguaging and really convince them that, yes, we want our students to do well in tests.
But there's a big difference, I think, in convincing teachers. Because most teachers will do what works, right? So the idea is if I'm in a classroom and I can use translanguaging or transpositioning strategies and better affect the students and assist the learning, that's actually something that's easy to convince teachers of. But if you have a principal going through the hallway and yelling at teachers who are trying to do it, obviously, that's a huge disincentive. So it's kind of dealing with the macro, the meso, and then the micro levels where, you know, to affect policy is a real issue.
No, I think so. I think when I say teachers, I also include the principals because they used to be teachers, right? So, I mean, it's educators in general. We have to let them know the benefits of translanguaging because at the end of the day, we want the students to understand the concepts. Because if they don't understand the concepts in class, then there's no learning. That's just as simple as that. And we just try our best, really. But Derek, you mentioned that you have heard cases where, we as linguists were successful in making changes in language policy. Do you want to say more?
Oh, I'm being interviewed now. Excellent.
I'm just curious.
No,
we'll be here for another 40 minutes now.
No, I'm talking, so in places like Australia where they've integrated various parts of a genre-based pedagogy, for example, into the curriculum.
That's a good example.
Yeah, they fundamentally changed the way that literacy is kind of explored. Now, this isn't uncontroversial. I'm aware of recent work that has kind of challenged this and then the response. Because as we know, what counts as evidence in an educational environment is particularly fraught. So, you know, this is really fascinating work, but it's easy to dismiss from a policymaker standpoint because they'll say, oh, well, this is interesting, but it's not statistically significant, right? Mm. You don't have 1,000 cases of transpositioning with pretest and post-test proving that the outcomes have been, you know what I mean? So that becomes very difficult is what counts as evidence. From a qualitative point of view, I think that this is really powerful because you look at this and you think, oh, as an educator, exactly as Mary started here and saying, I'm thinking about my own practice and what I do and how I can connect with students and better facilitate their learning.
I think that leads quite nicely into my next question, actually, which was... this project was quite a big undertaking, I think. You know, it was a big deal. You had to set up equipment, you had to get participants and everything. So there was a lot went into it. So how exactly did this come about? I mean, why did you make the decision to actually write this paper and study this topic?
So the data of this paper came from my doctoral research that I finished my PhD in 2021. And then because the concept of transpositioning was being proposed in December 2023. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of remember about because I published several papers about co-learning and also embodied enactment. That's the second example in the paper, which talks about how the teacher mobilized different body movements to create imaginary hypothetical scenarios. And I thought, wait, hold on a minute. These two examples, to me, they are transpositioning. But then it's just I didn't use the term before. So I decided to write this paper to really highlighting the fact that the kind of practices some teachers are engaging in, you know, can also be considered as transpositioning.
I'm really glad to hear that, actually, because that's a good sort of example to our PhD students who are listening about how your kind of doctoral research and the data that you get still continues to shape your academic career.
Yes.
Quite a few years later, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you can take a fresh perspective on it.
Yes.
Indeed.
Right. So as things emerge, you know, the same kind of data you can think back on and say, wait, I think I saw something like this you know, and the kind of reflective interviewing afterwards, I found particularly helpful here. Mm. So you have both a primary data of the teacher in the classroom. You can do a kind of multimodal discourse analysis and multilingual discourse analysis on that. But then you can also get the participants' interpretation of the parts of that and see if what you're... Yeah. thinking or what you're analyzing holds water to them.
Yeah. This particular way of combining the multimodal conversation analysis with the teacher's reflective interview, I mean, this arrangement aligns with the concept of translanguaging space. So this is another concept in the paper. It's about when we are engaging in translanguaging, we are essentially creating an interactional space for for multilinguals to engage in translanguaging. And during that process, when we do translanguaging, we bring in our diverse personal history, identity, beliefs that shapes how we use languages. Mm. So if we invite our teachers or students to reflect on their own classroom experience and why are they engaging in translanguaging in that way, you will see that, you know, very likely it's influenced by their pedagogical beliefs or their prior knowledge or the ways that, or the prior history. That's just how they normally do things. So, yeah.
Which is also how these policies come about. Right? When you have a certain approach where you're saying, well, the only way to learn a language is through immersion or through, you know, the only way to get the knowledge in EMI is to solely operate within English. And you lose the kind of delicacy or the tools that actually might come in handy based on existing knowledge and the kind of, we've talked about Vygotsky before here with the idea of well, where is this ZPD, this zone of proximal development? How do we scaffold the students from what they're not quite able to do into being independently capable of doing it? And this, I think making use of a L1 or other resources is a really powerful tool because we have the same goal, which is to get the students to the part where they can do it themselves. But do we have to struggle the whole way getting there?
Yes.
You say that this research came out of your doctoral research originally, but how did you become interested in this subject, this translanguaging specifically? Is it your own background?
I studied in an EMI school in Hong Kong for 3 years. And then from year 9 to year 12, I went to Sydney, Australia for my high school education. And what I have noticed is that when I was in Sydney, Australia, because I went to a boys' school and majority of the students were white Australian, and I felt that my linguistic knowledge wasn't being appreciated because all you have to do is, I was being yelled by some teachers and students that speak English, like just don't bother to speak other languages. And I just thought something felt wrong about this. It's like the kind of linguistic knowledge or the repertoire that I own just doesn't play a role in my own education.
Well, you certainly showed them.
And I just think it's so wrong about this. Mm-hmm. And then in Australia, I think back in 2011, they were implementing a multiculturalism policy. So I just thought, how come there's something wrong with the government saying about multiculturalism? But then in school, I was being told not to speak other languages.
Mm-hmm. Or even other forms of the English, probably. I mean, I don't know what your situation was like, but certainly the idea of which accent is a prestige accent or a correct one or the proper way to engage in education. One of the examples from your paper I thought was really interesting, which was the idea of the Finnish students learning English, but with a Finnish accent. So they would deliberately add that in. And this is another huge can of worms, which is the idea of...
There have been a lot of cans of worms.
Well, that's what we do here. We dig into the really important issues. But this one is about language standards and whose language is correct or which one is valued or which one is seen as aesthetically or intellectually correct. And of course, that's hugely problematic because it devalues knowledge of non-standard speakers, even when the knowledge might be superior.
I think it's because of my own personal experience. And then the idea of translanguaging came out. And I thought, okay, that resonates with my own, power experience. And I think that's something I can do about it.
I'd also like to ask, you published in the journal Language and Education, which sounds like the ideal journal for this topic, and also extremely highly ranked journal. So congratulations on that publication. It was only published very recently. So I'm guessing there hasn't yet been any sort of criticism or any response sort of to the article too much. But perhaps you'd like to say what kind of discussion or conversation you would like your project in this article and your publication to have started.
So, because the idea of transpositioning actually has received some criticisms from scholars, particularly in the field of conversation analysis, because they think, because I mentioned the idea of transpositioning was informed by the concepts of positioning theory and liquid modernity. Conversation analysts, they often use positioning theory to understand how speakers adopt different identity or social roles in social interactions. So they don't understand why there's a need to have a term called transpositioning. So I think what I can say is, because they don't understand translanguaging and how that concept shaped transpositioning. So that's something that we still need to convince, you know, the scholars who work on conversation analysis.
Does this mean we're going to get lots of complaints from conversation analysis after this?
Oh, they listen and they try to pick this apart each time. Yeah. So we've got a whole phalanx of conversation analysts who are... No, but interestingly to me, of course, I see these phenomena as intertwined, but not overlapping fully. Mm. So just because you have translanguaging taking place doesn't necessarily mean there's transpositioning. Mm. And just because you have transpositioning taking place doesn't mean that there's necessarily translanguaging.
Yeah.
But they can be potentially signals for one another as well, which I thought the data drew out very nicely. So that, you know, you can have an identity position, for example, as more of a learner when you're employing an L1, but not necessarily. You don't have to be. And so to me, I was wary at first. So when I first encountered the idea of transpositioning, I thought, well, why do you need this? But then as I was reading through, you convinced me. And so that was really an excellent bit of learning for me as well. So,
and it can often be very difficult to convince, Derek.
Of almost anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, the sky is blue. No, today is
we
Tuesday.
All tried and failed. Yeah, completely. Yeah.
So the important question here for us, Kevin, is what is next? How are you going to take this kind of transpositioning theory and move it forward?
Yeah.
Are you going to convince the government or are you, what comes out of this?
So at the moment, I'm leading a research project that's a project funded by the Research Grants Council of Hong Kong, looking at how translanguaging can play a role in reducing ethnic minority students' foreign language anxiety when they learn Chinese as a second language. Because this group of ethnic minority students, they are quite vulnerable in many ways. You know, they are forced to learn Chinese in schools. Their English proficiency is fine, actually, probably better than their teachers. It's the Chinese bit that.
Well, depending where they're from as well, there can be a myriad of.
Yeah, a lot of them are from South Asian countries, so they speak Urdu, Indian, Punjabi. And recently, I have a new article published in System, which is another leading journal in the field of linguistics. And together with Tongqing Li, who is the proposer of this concept of transpositioning, we were arguing that it plays a role in reducing students' foreign language anxiety. And we developed a translanguaging, transpositioning, and co-learning framework where if you are engaging in co-learning and you are engaging in transpositioning, engaged students willing to learn Chinese with you.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. I look forward to reading more about it, actually. And that's amazing work.
Absolutely.
And really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, we wish you all the best with that. And thank you very much for coming to UNNC. Good luck with your presentation that I know you're giving very soon to the School of English, Education English. But thank you very much for coming on our podcast. And we appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media, and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.